Good. Welcome. Lovely to see each one of you. I'm David Goa, the director of the Chester Ronning Center at Augustana. This is a very distinct kind of evening for us because of the place that Bishop Schultz plays in the founding of the Chester Ronning Center. As many of you know, Augustana went through a series of struggles and challenges, and when the decision was made to see if the government of Alberta, as well as the University of Alberta, might not become a home for its, I'm not sure what to say, sort of fifth generation, then it really fell to Bishop Raymond and some others, both on the university side as well as on Augustana side, to think about how to, well, for us Christians, we would say, how to pull life from death. It's an old Christian theme. How to actually see if one can make something that appears to be, at least for many, a kind of disaster and tragedy. How to see if something cannot be pulled forward from that, that will be fruitful and life-bearing, both for the community that built Augustana and has sustained it, and also for the life of the larger world. And so it is in part, large part, due to Bishop Raymond, that the Ronning Center was created. I have a story I tell myself about this, and I don't allow history to get in the way. I'm a philosopher, not a historian. I have historians as friends in order to check me. And my story goes like this. There was a recognition within both the bishop as well as the provost of the university and other good colleagues around the table, a recognition that one of the great needs in our time was to have a center which could bring together in an interdisciplinary way scholars and activists to think about all of those knotty matters where religion and public life intersect, and where, given the thinness of our way of thinking and talking about those matters, we tend to have an accident. So the Ronning Center's aim and purpose is to, I love this old phrase from the psalmist, pour the oil of gladness on the wounds that so often exist in our culture, in our society, in our politics, and within religious communities themselves around these very difficult and demanding questions and issues and themes. We simply must learn to think about them with more complexity, with more depth and texture than we have. The time is over when those on the right and those on the left, those who are liberal, those who are conservative, define themselves that way, those who define themselves as secular, those that define themselves as religious, the time is over when they can afford, for the sake of our common life, to simply rest in their own righteousness. It isn't easy. It's demanding. But it's also grand to be able to think in deeper and more complex ways. Ways that are transformative instead of driving people further into their own silos. So, I'm grateful very grateful that this initiative was taken by the bishop and others, and that we have a chance to do the little bit we can do to enhance the public conversation and the understanding both in religious communities as well as in various secular communities about these extraordinary issues we face, which are going to simply become a good deal more complex and demanding as we move thoroughly into the 21st century. So it's wonderful to have Bishop Schultz here tonight for his second lecture, in which he is addressing questions of faith and fear. Bishop Schultz, as at least some of you know, remains active in the Council of the Lutheran World Federation, particularly in the Council of the Council's Renewal Committee. He has been the National Bishop for Canada for the Lutheran Church. And last night, as we listened to him, I was reminded of how in the ancient church, and in the church when it has always been healthy, those who have the office of the episcopacy are first and foremost not CEOs. They are first and foremost teachers. And it was lovely last night to hear that embodied. So I'm grateful you've come, and I'm grateful that you will speak to us this evening. Welcome.
Thank you. Before he begins, could I ask you to clarify something? Even you and I are old friends. You referred to the naughty matters at church. Society has to address the naughty things. You are also NADGH.
Well, you know my natural dyslexia. So I use it in both ways.
Yes.
Oh, it's great to be here. I used to draw bigger crowds when I was in the CEO role, especially when our church was arguing about sexuality matters, and an awful lot of people turned up not to support me, but to heckle. But now that I'm talking about stuff that's different, it's not quite the same. Anyway, I'm glad to be here anyhow. This is a fairly long lecture, so if you nod off, that's okay. You probably need the rest. And it is being recorded, so later on you can go to the website and listen to it again and pick up the parts that you missed. So this is a two-part series called Love and Fear, Reflections on the Calling to be Fully Human. And I made the first presentation last night in Camrose. And so, because I don't think any of you were there in Camrose, what I'm going to do is just summarize in brief what I said there, and then move on to what I intend to be the focus of tonight's lecture. I introduced this topic last night beginning from my understanding of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures. And the two topics that my study focused were on love and fear. And the form of love that I want to talk about in this lecture has a particular meaning, which is detached from all of those more sentimental expressions that we call love in our popular culture. So popular literature will often refer to love and hate as being polar opposites. But my proposal to you tonight is that love and fear are the real opposites. And here's how I arrive at that conclusion. By my reading, the God of the scriptures remains only an idea unless God is experienced through relationships that human beings have with one another. God is an idea, and so love of God is nothing more than just an affection for an idea. Anybody can love the idea of God. That's what the word theology means, ideas about God. But when and how does God become an experience? So So my premise is that God can only be experienced through our relationships with each other. And Christian theology teaches that God's existence is known only in and only through humans. That's what the scriptures tell us. Somebody wrote to us from long ago about those experiences. That's what Christian theology means by incarnation. It isn't that human beings become gods, it's that God becomes among us. So humans then get their sense of value as a species from their meaningful relationship with God. That's what helps them to understand what it means to be who they are. And so then how humans live together is constituted by how they experience God. And so how they experience each other is absolutely essential to how they experience what God means. So in the founding stories of the Hebrew Scriptures, those founding stories recognize that humans are like other animals. You know, we're primates. George Carlin says we're different in that we walk upright all the time. But other than that, that's who we are. Primates experience a fight or flight hormonal response when they're confronted with fear. And fight or flight means that one either tries to destroy the cause of the fear, or if you don't think you're strong enough to do that, then you run away. So Genesis 3 is a story about how humans came to be afraid of God. And they became afraid of God because they imagined ideas about God that threatened them. The snake said, you know, you can know more things than God is telling you. You're just being kept dumb. And so Adam and Eve are tempted to believe that God is deliberately keeping them that way. And they think that if they were only admitted to the inner workings of God's mind, then they could be like God themselves. That's what the story talks about. Their experience tells them that they cannot survive without God's providence. But the temptation and the imagination is there. And so that temptation creates enormous conflicts for them. God has been good to them, but they want to reject God in favor of their own divinity. And God's great grief in that story is that humans are not content to be what they are. They're no longer happy to be the creatures they were created to be. They want to be something else. Now, God has taken just as much delight in creating humans as in creating other creatures, or at least it started out that way. Some days I wonder whether that's still the case. But humans are always tempted to believe that because God is God, God cannot possibly love them as equals. See, our culture has created a lie. Well, it's created lots. My dad and mom told me a few. Our culture has created the lie that love is not voluntary. That love is something you have to earn. You have to be cute enough. You have to be good enough. You have to be kind enough. You know. So when God approaches Adam and Eve, they hide themselves. And then when God asks them why, Adam says, well, we were afraid. And fear becomes the stimulus then for disengaging, because who can beat God? So the only alternative is to run away. And Adam and Eve are afraid to admit what they have been thinking. They can no longer be candid. They are no longer transparent. God is no longer a partner in their conversation. Their increasing isolation and distrust pulls them further and further away from the experience of sharing life together. Fear causes people to reject the creator of the universe, no matter how generous and loving that creator may be. So, it's one of the earliest stories of our founding scriptures. But what the Christian church saw in Jesus was an alternative to this fear-love conflict that was going on. And after Jesus died, the church taught that he embodied God in his own person, so that he lived in such a way that God was present. And he led his disciples to see that God would be present among them also. And it was a new way of understanding the value of other people. So Jesus, before he died, had one last dinner with his friends. And that became the Eucharist. And the Eucharist in the Christian churches is a reenactment of Jesus' farewell meal. But it's a ritual through which the people of God participate in the experience of Christ, re-participate in his faith, and re-participate in his vision and in his experience with God in the presence of their community, free of fear and motivated by mutual belonging. In the 24th chapter of Luke's Gospel, there's a story about two disciples. This is after Jesus' death. The two disciples are going back to the town of Emmaus, and Jesus joins them on the road and then stays and has dinner with them. And they talk about the scriptures. And then when it comes time to eat, he blesses the meal. And the quotation, what they're quoted as saying is, look how our hearts were burning within us when he was present. And so Matthew's gospel recalls Jesus telling his disciples, wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there am I. So God is incarnate not in this special person, although Jesus is central to the creation of the religion that we follow, but that God is always present where people are gathered around the same faith by which Jesus lived. He is alive to them in their mutuality. That's how God exists in the world, is among human beings. Outside of that, God is just an idea. So St. Paul, who was the first, it was the earliest writer of any of the Christian scriptures, long before the Gospels were written, decades before, he chose the Greek term agape to describe the quality of this mutual life of people in the church. And he said, in such a way of life, humans will embody the presence of God to each other. And Martin Luther described that presence of God as being that to which we look for all good. So if you want a working definition for God from Martin Luther, that's it. That to which we look for all good. And the fullness of what good humanity can be then is experienced through a relationship in which each party is willing to meet the needs of the other without fearing the other. Agape doesn't preclude other forms of love. You know, the Greeks had lots of words. We just have one. There's eros, you know, which is why little babies get made after a while. And there are philias, which are loyalties to state and to various philosophies and ideas and so on. Friendship, love of learning and so on. All of these are different words for love in the Greek vocabulary. Well, agape doesn't do away with any of these. Rather, it forms a ground in which these forms of love then can be expressed in the fullest way. So St. Paul taught that the agape that originated with Jesus was a model for all the other relationships. And it is best described as the willingness to meet the needs of the other. Now, there's a lot of unpacking that we can do with that. Agape is voluntary. and it isn't attached to whether the person is desirable or anything else. Agape is voluntary and sees the other person equally as being equally human. And the various expressions of love then against that background can bloom into full humanity when they're planted in that kind of soil. On the other hand, agape and fear cannot coexist, because fear refuses to see an equal human in the other person. So whenever human beings threaten each other, even for the sake of some abstract good, you know, they stimulate a response in the other that always results in alienation or destructive behavior. So if humans theorize that God is threatening, they become alienated not only from God, but they become alienated from each other as well. Love of God and love of humanity are essentially the same thing. So it's possible, therefore, for human beings either to regard others as equals or to perceive them as being a threat. And even though those threats may be only imagined, not real, they still can result in this old primal response of hypertension that's filled with anxiety and anger and aggression. And out of it comes alienation and chronic fear and distrust and conspiracy theories and prejudices of all kinds and xenophobia. Just fear of anything that is other. So that's what I talked about last night, and they probably would have been happier if I had only taken that long to say that. So now I want to move on to what I want tonight's lecture to be about, and to illustrate how I see these ideas working themselves out, at least in a few examples of what's going on in today's world. I said in last night's lecture that in spite of all the fear that's rampant in the world, the gospel of agape remains alive and well among us and was not destroyed. So I want to start with this heartwarming little story. A nice lady by the name of Sheena Meadowcroft. She came from Gabriola Island to Vancouver for the opening of the Olympics to join a protest against homelessness and all the commercialization of the Winter Games and violations of civil rights and so on. So she was along with those other marchers, but then she became appalled because some of the protesters started to get violent. But she still wanted to stay with the cause. She believed in the protest. But when she tried to have a rational conversation with one of the agitators about the violence, the agitator spit on her. In contrast, she saw how controlled the police were. So she wrote a letter to Constable Rob Marriott of the Vancouver Police Department, thanking him and his colleagues for representing everything that is good about Canada. And the reason she did that is because Constable Marriott saw that she was getting caught up in a crowd that she didn't know how to handle. And so what he did is he buffered her and made sure that she was safe. So here are some quotes from her letter. "I've never been surrounded by so many gentlemen in my life. Your men were continuously insulted and spat upon, screamed at. At no time did I see any of them respond with anything but civility and politeness. Thank you is simply not enough to show you my gratitude, respect, and above all, admiration." See, the ethic of love that arises from agape is not a sentiment. I don't know whether that constable approved of the demonstrators or not. But agape is a deliberately cultivated attitude towards other people. It is a way for humanity to be the blessing to the world that Martin Luther's source of all good is supposed to be. It's a cultivated spiritual posture, and it requires maturity and it requires discipline to act for the sake of others. That's why Constable Marriott was able to protect Sheena Meadowcroft, because of the discipline and the training, took planning and training to enable that police officer to act the way that he did. And whether he condoned her or not, he could still respond to her real needs, which in this case was the need for safety. So he's mobilized by his love. Now, fear can mobilize society too, but the outcomes generally result in alienation or destruction. The suggested danger doesn't even have to be true. It only has to be plausible and persuasive. My favorite example is the children's story about Chicken Little. The sky wasn't falling, but the barnyard got in a flurry anyway. Example, Copenhagen climate change talks were completely derailed by the contention that a university in England had produced misleading data as a partisan propaganda measure. Whether the contention is true or not, people reacted out of fear when they heard that. Fear that the whole climate change enterprise was merely concocted in order to benefit certain scientists. They're making work for themselves. And the outcome is that now trust in leadership on climate change has broken down, and truth-telling has become indistinguishable from ideological rhetoric. That kind of fear stimulates people to resist positive measures, and they take actions based on personal interest rather than on the common good. On the other hand, when people are unafraid, they then are willing to dare to enter into the reality of the other person's experience and see things the way the other person sees them. They're willing to share the walk, to take the risk, to celebrate the joys, and also to endure any bitterness that may result out of the experience. Here's another story. This was in the Vancouver Sun on March 2nd. The Lutheran Church, together with the Anglicans and some other agencies, operate Surrey Urban Mission. Surrey is the big city to the south of Vancouver. It's about 800,000 people. And Surrey Urban Mission is located right in the urban core of this big city. Anyway, let me start with how the story in the Sun started. Unemployed and down on his luck, Doug Oliver is one of Vancouver's estimated 450 homeless people. So he has nothing much to call his own. The clothes on his back are his only possessions, and his bed is a rough bunk in a very crowded men's shelter. John Keel Hallgate is the executive director of the Surrey Urban Mission, which is a nonprofit organization, and it works with the homeless and with marginalized people. Now, she says, Oliver is a great example of why the public needs to rethink its definition of the homeless in our cities. Because somewhere along the line, she said, we've wrongly confused people's financial status with their level of integrity and their level of worth. She said, here's a man who has not one penny in his pocket, yet when he found a wallet with money in it, he still had the honesty to turn the money in. When they asked him why he did that, he said, that's the right thing to do. So Hallgate was thrilled then because she and her agency were involved in this city-driven project that was piloted at the Olympic Celebration Center in Surrey. And here's what they did. The program involved people like Oliver in volunteer work with the city's sustainability squad that had been set up in the celebration site. The team helped, this team, folks from this center, helped to compost 2 dumpsters worth of garbage every day and recycled 10,000 cans and bottles every day. There were about 23 volunteers. They're all accredited through the mission. Most of them were were either homeless or had recently been living on the streets, and they worked in shifts where they came on at 5 o'clock and worked until 11, and they made regular rounds of the site, and they picked through its many garbage bags and took all the recyclables out. And the director said, you know, people see dumpster diving in a negative sense, but we want to put a face on it and turn it into something positive. She said, we're all into environmental things and recycling and stuff, and our friends here are like the ultimate recyclers. However, some people were very slow to accept these volunteers as part of this team. Some people just haven't crossed that barrier, she said. It reminded me of a First Nations comedian that I saw in Winnipeg. And here's how he talks about how people deal with the poor. He said, I like to stand on Portage Avenue in downtown Winnipeg, and I see some businessmen hurrying along, and so I say, hey. And he said, doesn't like to look at me, but I say, hey, come here, eh? He said, the guy doesn't want to come, but I keep after him. Come here, come here. He said, when the guy finally comes up to me, I reach in my pocket, pull out a handful of change and say, would you like some money to buy a cup of coffee? He said, I try never to judge a man by the color of his neck. Unwillingness to enter into the humanity of the other is the issue. Now, I want to talk a little bit about global terrorism. This is a large arena. There's a lot of politics related to it. And please keep in mind that I'm still just limiting my analysis to love and fear. See, the terrorist activities that are reported in the news media have a distinct pattern to them. Leaders recruit young people who they can persuade to believe that the world is going to hell. And they teach that Western culture has become so corrupt that its influence will destroy the goodness of their way of life. The world has become a quagmire of sin. They, on the other hand, are a clean people, meant to live in the kingdom of God. All they need is a solid knowledge of those things that will lift them out of the mud of this sorry planet to a place where their spirits will live in ethereal bliss. And they're taught that true believers possess this knowledge and that their efforts are essential to saving the world. And anyone who opposes them is intrinsically evil. When I read that description in a journalistic essay, I said, ah, I know this. I was a Lutheran pastor at UBC for 10 years, from 81 to 91. And I saw that same activity repeated over and over again. We called them cults back then. But their campus workers would look for students who were unfocused or didn't have any friends and looking lonely, and they would persuade them that their moral culture was in grave danger. And so they had so-called Bible studies, weekend camps, work projects. The inductees were indoctrinated in the so-called true way and then exploited by their leaders to do what they wanted. No matter what the groups called themselves, they routinely use sleep deprivation, constant accompaniment. They never let anybody alone. They were isolated from their family and any other person who would do some critical thinking about what was going on, because they wanted to keep the recruits from developing any skepticism. So the training camps in Yemen and elsewhere are operating like this. They take young people away from critical analysis that their parents and friends might provide to them and isolate them in environments where a rigid ideology is enforced constantly. They're treated to warm friendships. There's big brotherly camaraderie and mentoring. And then they are absorbed into the worldview, and then they are trained for various roles in the organization. And the grief and the heartache of their good-hearted and peaceful Muslim families is painful to the extreme. And all the piety that these people taught their children is being exploited for the purpose of concocted fear. These young people might as well be drug addicts, and the drug on which they become dependent is fear. Fear of another society, fear of another culture, fear of another worldview. They are taught to fear a God who has chosen their side from among all of the world's people and who will not tolerate otherness. So if you break away, then you're over there. There's only one way. On the other hand, pull off a successful suicide bombing and you end up a hero in the lap of paradise. And the ordinary Muslim families who have for centuries shown themselves to be peaceful, generous, and neighborly people are devastated by what is happening among them. Most of them have coexisted for centuries with Jewish, Christian, Hindu, and Buddhist neighbors. Al-Rashid Mosque has been here in Edmonton since 1938. Now, Christian history has its own terrorist episodes. Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire in the 4th century, and that provided the church with an opportunity to assemble such power that even after the Roman Empire was defeated, the church continued its dominance over governments and over cultures. And unlike the terrorists of today, the fear-mongering wing of the church was an official part of the apparatus. It was called the Inquisition. And anybody who dared to have an opinion that was out of step with church doctrine knew that the Inquisition would hunt them down and subject them to an ugly and torturous and painful death. So heretics are burned at the stake or barbecued or flayed and drawn and quartered. And on top of that, because the church taught that there is life after death, the relatives of those condemned sinners then were made to pay ransom to release their souls from ongoing agony. I mean, all the emperor could do is execute you. The church could just keep making you pay to get Auntie Ruth out of there. Pagan religions were converted wholesale. Their holidays were co-opted by the church calendar and reinterpreted to become part of the Christian story. Someday I could show you the little essay I wrote about the Christmas tree. The church eventually made the world pagan, the word pagan, in fact, synonymous with evil and witchcraft and devil worship. It was no longer a cultural description. Fear of pagans was reinforced by images of a burning hell and an apocalyptic end to the world that God intended for anyone who participated in sins like that. Now, these days, it's the Protestant fundamentalists who are using those kinds of images to motivate people. Evangelist Tim LaHaye, his writing partner Jerry Jenkins, have set outstanding sales records for their Left Behind novels. These are novels that describe the coming of the rapture when Jesus returns and wreaks gory vengeance upon everybody except born-again Christians. So the books describe Christ casting billions of Hindus and Muslims and Buddhists and Jews and Catholics and Unitarians and secular people and others all into hell. So one of the quotes from the book is, "Jesus merely raised one hand a few inches and they tumbled in howling and screeching," one novel says. And it notes gleefully that the flesh of non-Christians dissolves from their skeletons as they hurtle into the abyss. Whew. The Left Behind series has passed 60 million sales. It's America's most lucrative book venture ever. It outsells all the works, even the best writing of Nobel and Pulitzer Prize winners. Well, those kinds of contemporary doomsday ideologies all share a common attribute. It's the resistance to the development of scientific thinking and all of this tolerance of postmodernism for diversity in our world. See, science demystified the world by demonstrating that the world can be understood through a process of rational thought. So astronomy and physics and biology demonstrated a life process that involves very complex interactions of particles, subatomic and atomic and molecular, and that all of these can be described with advanced mathematics. And germs and viruses were understood to be the causes of disease, not the actions of supernatural demons or evil spirits. And the planets move as they do because of gravitational and other forces, not because of the whim of some deity or other. And neuropsychology and brain plasticity theory have revolutionized the way that we understand how people think and even how the brain controls bodily functions and how it can even be trained to do them in a different way. And so blind people can be made to see through their tongues now. It's not a very good lens, but they're getting there. Objectivity, not subjectivity, has become the test of truth. Theories must be repeatably demonstrable. The ethics of science requires it. Anything else is opinion. It's possible that it's true, but it cannot be authoritative without that test. So that was the beginning. That's the scientific age. And even though global exploration was primarily motivated by the economics of colonialism, you know, that's why all the great explorers came and why Canada is what it is now, it provided the data by which the world's people became aware of each other and became less parochial than they had been before. And so the scientific era enlarged the comprehension of human knowledge. But that expanded human volume of knowledge meant that the world had become a much more complicated place now to organize and to govern. And it raised the question of how do we deal with all the issues in a responsible way? And now we live in an era that we call the postmodern era. And the postmodern world is a pluralistic world. Ideas abound in all shapes and sizes, and even science, demonstrable as many of its discoveries are, contributes to truth only one particle at a time. Comprehensive view of the cosmos does not exist. Cosmologists like Einstein and now, having a memory lapse, Stephen Hawking keep looking for a grand unification theory, but it isn't there. Human society is caught up in all of this. Developments in knowledge and discovery have not happened at the same rate and in the same historical context the world over. So what was discovered 100 years ago in one setting is still foreign to people in another setting today. Or now they're discovering it, but now the setting is different. So it means something different than it did 100 years ago. And if somebody asked him, why was the great train robbery of the Victorian era called the Great Train Robbery? More money has been stolen in other train robberies and so on. But they said it was because of the development of steam power and the railway was the epitome of technological achievement to the Victorian era, and so it was seen as an assault on the way of life. So if somebody robs a train now, first of all, it probably won't arrive on time anyway, but even, you know, it's a different setting, so it means something different now. That's what I'm saying. So the same events are happening around the world, but at different times. And so they mean different things to different people. So some cultures and religions, even today, continue to be based largely on mythological lore, nothing that we would consider to be hard knowledge. Others resist knowledge because that might challenge the validity or the sacredness of their cultural practices. So they do what the snake told Eve, they're keeping them dumb. And we have now developed, at least in our society, a scientifically clinical approach to sexual practices. And so that has displaced the moral and cultural regulation that there used to be over human sexuality with something that I would call a more human rights-based approach. So we can talk about a woman's right to control her own fertility, for example. That wasn't possible 100 years ago. Many Christians and Muslims, of course, are outraged by this development. Churches are being torn apart over disputes about patriarchy and women's rights to control their fertility and the recognition that gender identity may be somewhat more fluid than we have assumed in the past. See, anyone can hold any opinion in a postmodern world. But that postmodern world tends to treat all the ideas of as equal. That's why it's not safe to go on Wikipedia. Because opinion and fact are treated the same. Okay? So you can hold any moral position you want, but it will be seen in our society as only one possible position among hundreds of others. And if all ideas are equal, and the world is crammed with a plurality of ideas, what should one believe? And to what truth should one commit? So, postmodernism creates feelings of tremendous uncertainty and lack of focus. And so it looks like the society's going to hell because nothing's holding it together. And those who fear for the certainty of their worldview then may go on the offensive and want nothing to do with the ideas that they reject, even though those ideas might enhance human existence. But because they add to a plurality of ideas that don't fit in the framework, out they go. So Philip Jenkins wrote this. He said, recent violence between Muslims and Christians raises the danger that Nigerian society might be brought to ruin by the clash of jihad and crusade. Muslims and Christians are at each other's throats in Indonesia, the Philippines, Sudan, and a growing number of other African nations. Hindi extremists persecute Christians in India. Demographic projections suggest that these feuds will simply worsen. Fear is the most powerful drug in world history. And those who control fear can prevent human beings from seeing in other people the same humanity that they possess. We know that from the Holocaust. Those who manipulate fear can make the case that our current society has reduced God to a helpless deity whose sovereignty is no longer respected. And so to offset that premise then, an ideology of fear comes with an all-powerful God who rewards only the faithful and consigns to punishment anybody who is the other. So the old snake of the Garden of Eden is at work again, tempting the gullible to believe that fear and not regard for the other is the way that God controls things. And so God's heart breaks, and she weeps over her children, and all creation groans with longing for its liberation. Those are the words of the prophets and St. Paul of old. The terrible irony is that fear doesn't build anything, it just begets more fear. So the war on terrorism that was launched by the United States has done nothing but feed the certainty of the terrorists. And the powerful military aggression and the sophisticated military equipment that has been employed by the Western nations becomes a symbol of the demonic power that these evil forces possess, and therefore anything goes in defeating them. So the Globe and Mail on March 4th had an opinion piece by Jehina Dillon. Jehina Dillon is a fellow at Harvard University's State Building and Human Rights for Afghanistan and Pakistan program. And these are just a couple of quotes from her. She says, after meeting with tribal and religious leaders all over the country, it was clear that the efficiency and accessibility of the informal justice system, that is the one they used to use, one that is steeped in history and based on familiar traditions, was what made it more attractive to Afghans. So why does the international community continue to spend money on a policy that builds institutions with only a limited effect on building rule of law and justice, and ultimately governance and security in Afghanistan? The international community has too often approached the development of institutions in post-conflict states from the perspective that they know best how to solve the problems there. But this viewpoint is naive and short-sighted. Short-sighted in that we cannot simply transplant Western values regarding institutional ideas of justice into Afghanistan without accommodation made for the historical developments and the cultural nuances of the Afghan constitutional and judicial systems. Other writers have picked other aspects to say the same thing. Now, North American fundamentalists support the war out of many of the same kinds of fears as I have read expressed in pronouncements from Al-Qaeda. It's creating an image of a demanding God who disapproves of humanity in general and approves only of those who exhibit the right behavior and the right ideology. So the Pew Research Center for People and the Press last year released a version of what it calls its landscape survey. And it says that many people who left the religion to become unaffiliated say they did so in part because they think of religious people as hypocritical or judgmental, because religious organizations focus too much on rules, or because religious leaders are too focused on power and money. See, an ethic of love doesn't have to be sappy or emotional or cowardly or weak. It takes a concerted social and political will to make it a reality and a policy for the world's people. So I'm going to conclude with this quotation from Karl Rainer Rilke. He writes, I find it confusing to no end that so much difficulty and pain originate in the ultimately superfluous and unnecessary distortions and paralyses of existence, which for times immemorial have resulted from the non-wakefulness, sluggishness, and narrowness of human circumstances, and which have been heaped in great quantities on that which is intended as life's joy. And yet I see what is happening as a summons to raise our eyes to the new order which God has envisioned for this postmodern age. All that is needed is that our eyes be a trace more seeing, our ears more receptive to the presence of God's created spirit, that we be more present-minded and less oblivious, in order to recognize God with us and perceive all of the millions of possibilities, openings, and futures in which something that has been thwarted is unexpectedly fulfilled. Thank you.
He hasn't given us very much to chew on here, but maybe some of you might like to enter in a little bit. Who would like to pick up on this and engage part of what's being said, please?
Since fear is what separates us from our God, Jesus, I see it, and I have seen for a long time, fear of the devil.
Can you all hear?
No.
Since fear is what separates us from God. Next.
I believe that my way of seeing it is that fear is the main devil.
So fear is the devil.
Yeah.
Wouldn't argue with that.
Would you mind reading that last passage by Rami again? Just the last passage.
Did you want to develop that at all, or just you're looking for?
Yes, I'd like to develop that, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Continue.
Sure. It's two paragraphs. The second paragraph reads, "And yet I see what is happening as a summons to raise our eyes to the new order which God has envisioned for this postmodern age. All that is needed is that our eyes be a trace more seeing, our ears more receptive to the presence of God's creative spirit, that we be more present-minded and less oblivious in order to recognize God with us and perceive all of the millions of possibilities, openings, and futures in which something that has been thwarted is unexpectedly fulfilled." And the first paragraph argues that full humanity has been thwarted because we chase down all these things that make us afraid and prevent progress in human relationships. And so life becomes an agony that was intended to be an experience of joy.
So, did you want to go a little bit further with what you had raised?
Well, fear is the opposite of love. I have a relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask one leave it there. Can you expand on that or not?
Well, yeah, and I can come at it from this side, and I can come at it from this side, right? The scriptural stories describe a God who creates the world out of love and takes delight in the world that was created. But then the Garden of Eden story says that suspicion enters in. Suspicion about God's motives.
That's fear.
That's fear. That's right. Okay. But I also said that we don't experience God except through our relationships with each other. Jesus said that once too. He said, what are the two greatest commandments? Love God. He said, the other one is the same thing. Love your neighbor as yourself. You can't love God apart from a loving relationship with human beings. So what happens is that when we fail to recognize in the other person that this is the vehicle through which we experience God because of fear, and that is also a rejection of God. You know, the Eucharist, we call the Eucharistic sacrament the means of grace, but it isn't. The ritual meal isn't actually the means. The people who gather are. Because what we believe about the Eucharist is that the life that Christ lived was handed to the disciples at the Last Supper. and it just keeps being handed on and handed on. So the presence of God in the world is the people who participate in the ritual. That's the means of grace. There's a hand up there. Angela.
There was one right here first, if I may. Yeah.
I felt that there is an ideology of escapism, fear of pain, which I think is a pity, because if you're unwilling to feel pain, I don't think that person can ever experience true joy.
So there's an ideology of
avoiding
escapism,
pain.
Avoiding pain, and if you live your life that way, you can't ever have the joy.
See, if fear, this fight or flight syndrome evolved in mammals like us, because it's also a survival tactic. I mean, there are real threats. You know, Woody Allen said, even paranoids have real enemies. Right? So when you're facing a real threat, when you're a bunny being chased by a coyote, it's smart to run because you're not big enough to fight. Okay? So that's legitimate. But it's when we develop fears about things that are not threatening that then it wreaks such havoc with the spiritual relationships that we have in our communities.
Sorry, Ray, you're probably expecting this question from me. I just think it kind of begs the question with respect to how it is that we are in the world and how we treat our fellow human beings with civility and respect, that it requires an idea of God. And I would beg to differ, that's not necessary.
I didn't say that. What I was doing was describing the theology of the scriptures from which I began this lecture series.
Okay. I just don't. I mean, if you're going to put it in within that context, yeah, we can't argue outside of that. But I still think it kind of begs the question.
All human beings are the creation of God, and believers in God don't have a corner on the love market.
Oh, I'm not saying that that's the case, but I still think you still have to ask the question. Whether
you need the idea at all?
Yeah.
Okay. You can argue that if you want. It's not the main part of my thesis tonight. So.
But I would don't want to ask you the question, how is someone who does not have an idea of God, how can you qualify or quantify or explain their respectful behavior of others?
Well, I can't speak for others. All I was trying to do was to say, even in our scriptures, there's the recognition in these stories that what has screwed up human relationships is this tension between fear and the voluntary willingness to meet the needs of the other. In each society, responses to this have arisen for different reasons, and I'm not avoiding the question, but I can only speak about what I think I know a little bit about. Okay.
May I just dip my oar in on that one?
Okay.
You don't mind? I mean, classical Christian theology would argue that any human being who acts out of compassion and affection and friendship is in communion. It isn't about your abstract doctrine. Doctrinal views of deity, particularly, have always been a great problem in Christian theology. The great religious problem is the idea of God. Human beings have ideas of God which deal death. At the same time, the idea of the divine is a kind of placeholder for a regard for all that which is beyond us. It is a kind of placeholder for a language of wonder, of beauty, of truth. But classical Christian theology certainly doesn't have any problem with people that don't believe in God. That's not the issue. The issue is people that don't believe in themselves and don't believe in each other and thus deal death. So the other side of that is the 20th century is the great century of war and horrific activity based on atheistic ideology. Hitler, Joe Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, the list goes on. So it can be done from all sides. Yeah. Does that help at all? Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Maybe a little?
Nick, you had your hand up.
Sorry, it doesn't matter. So how do we deal with religious fundamentalists? Is there a way to help by giving, is it they need food, and what are they, you know, what? How can we make it better than it is? Because at the moment it's, the Westerners are awful and we must try to kill them, and then the Westerners come up in with the tanks and try to blow people up. Yeah. But that doesn't seem to be any kind of long-term solution.
So what's the prescription to deal with fear?
Yeah.
What's the prescription? The diagnosis is there. What's the prescription?
Yeah, I don't know. I can tell you what I have experienced, because I have lots of fears of my own. It's always experience transcending ideology, you know. I've been told things about people, then I meet them. I've been told about situations and then I find myself in them. And that's a transforming experience. The trouble with fundamentalism, whether it's Christian or Muslim or any other group, and it isn't limited only to Christianity. Fundamentalism is a way of approaching otherness. And it's a historical phenomenon that arose in opposition to the modernism and the scientific era and so on. And it's a very black and white way of looking at the world. It creates a framework and says, this is how things should be, and it puts into that framework what it wants, and then everything else is irrelevant. And so you can talk in there, as long as you talk the language of the framework. Out here, it doesn't matter what you say, you aren't going to be heard anyway. And so that's why a fundamentalism as a phenomenon is so difficult to deal with. And there are a couple of people in this room who've done a lot more analysis than I have of that. That's just been my experience. That's why I'm so happy not to be a bishop anymore.
Have you found at all that, just to follow up on it, that if you approach, let's speak in the Christian world, if you approach a Christian fundamentalist out of a kind of liberal ideology, or initially around whatever it is that divides you, like if that is your point of contact, you can kiss it goodbye.
Yeah, because you just heighten the threat.
You just heighten the threat.
Right.
But what about seeking to develop a conversation about the things that you might actually share, even if you share an entirely different perspective on them? I think of, you know, the narratives and the parables of the gospel are amazing. And at least in my experience with many fundamentalists, if I begin there, if I begin inquiring as to where those narratives were transformative for them, where did those narratives prove to be life-giving for them? Sometimes we get to second base. What's your experience? Have any sense of that?
I haven't had that experience.
Yeah.
But I'm not denying that that's...
Yes. It's the hazards of being a bishop.
It's probably one of the reasons why it's good that I'm not anymore.
There's a gentleman over here.
Yep.
What, in the context of what, as I see it, you're trying to get across to us this evening, how would you respond to a person who claims to be a humanist and still a good person in terms of how she or he relates to other people.
What's the issue for you in that question?
Well, I'm really asking, I suppose, can one be a good person without any form of religious beliefs whatsoever?
Yes. But you may be asking a religious question that has to do with salvation, which is a religious idea.
Yes. No, that's not quite the thing. I'm motivated by something else.
Yeah.
There was a Cambridge philosopher of the 30s. Actually, believe it or not, he rejoiced in the name of John Wisdom. And he got this idea partly from Wittgenstein, but the thing was this. If anybody asks you, what's the nature of reality? You can set out the steps that lead you to saying tables and chairs and things like that.
Yeah.
Then you switch over and set out the steps which lead you to say subatomic particles. With that total experience in your head, you now begin to see that the question was not quite, didn't have the character that you thought it had when you started off. There had to be one right answer.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm in.
Back to your original question. It's a question of how we treat ourselves so that everybody gets to be equally human. And some of this I talked about more last night, and I'm not getting that tonight. But how does everybody get to be equally human? Not everybody is born into the same circumstances. And so there are inequalities, the experiences that we have are often very impersonal. You know, it wasn't anybody's sin that caused the Dust Bowl in the 30s on the Canadian prairies, but it wreaked havoc on people. But when you look into that event, then you find how people care for each other and respected each other, and so on. And so what I'm looking for is, or what I wanted to talk about tonight, is that once we start regarding the other person as something other than the same as we are, then that becomes threatening, and then we either move away or we become destructive. We want to remove them. You know, like the street people in Surrey, who nobody wanted to have help with the Olympics. So that's the issue for me. So anybody that lives with other people in a way that makes that kind of community and equality happen and respect the other person is doing what I consider to be good.
Nicholas, did you have your hand up?
Well, I think my question has been partly asked and answered. But I'd like to restate it. When we are living in a world in which many individuals and groups, for various reasons, try to induce or even compel fear, what is our response? One thing we can do is not play. And in fact, the instruction is to love our enemies. But loving our enemies doesn't mean we let them get away with that.
No.
And it seems to me that there's a problem for us all in trying to reconcile our motive with our tactics.
Yeah.
Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I find myself agreeing with you, and you know, things need not have gone the way they did in the war on terrorism or the war against drugs. This country had a Nobel Prize winner in Lester Pearson who was able to find ways to bring parties together And the man for whom this Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, Chester Rodney's name, had those kinds of skills too. It was a great disappointment to him that the Western powers didn't listen to him about Vietnam. And so they refused engagement instead of doing the other. The trouble is, you know, all you can commit to is dialogue. And if you come into dialogue with a vested interest, then that just heightens the threat again. The only purpose for going into the dialogue is in order to understand. But that's the beginning, then, of being able to see the human in the other. And then it becomes at least the possibility that you can shift the imagination away from the sense of fear and threat to an imagination that there might be some possibilities. And then you can begin to bargain, at least. You know, when it comes to political issues, they don't have to be friends, just have to be peaceful and cooperative.
Bishop Ray, as I heard your dialogue with this gentleman over here,
yeah,
and also with Angela earlier, it occurred to me that I would like to hear your thoughts on the question, what is the purpose of the idea of God?
Okay. We thought of God.
Yes. But what is the purpose of that?
Well, Luther said, God is that to which we look for all good. Right? So the idea of God is that which represents what is best for us as human beings, but most of the time it arises out of a cultural setting in which it represents what is the ideal of that cultural group. And then what happened when the Western Church became part of the empire, then it became a culture to itself, separate even from the empire, and so then God became the possession of that particular cultural group, and all kinds of things were done with it. Okay? But that, so God always represents, for a group of people, that to which they aspire. What you do with it after that, whether you use it as a club over other people or whether you use it as a blessing, depends on how the system around it begins to be developed.
But setting aside using that idea as a club, for me, then, as I listen to this, there is not a need for the idea of God. Because that need can be met in some other way, and there is not a need for the idea of God.
Right, and that's what...
Where does that leave me?
And that's what's going on in our postmodernist world now, where it's so hard to find a center, and where it's so hard to find a cohesive and binding force that holds communities of people together. See, the idea of God isn't bad in and of itself. The idea of God turns into a bad thing when people perceive God to be a threat. And then they start treating each other that way. Right? Because the only way they experience that God is in the community gathered around that God. Because that God represents the values of their community.
So are you suggesting community shouldn't have a value?
I'm sorry. Again.
Are you suggesting that we'd be better off if communities didn't have a value?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm suggesting that those values that we strive for, important, do not necessarily require the idea of God.
Okay, that's right. They don't.
And so then we're saying, you know, then where are we left with respect to that idea of God?
Call
Mark. Not with respect to the values, but with respect to the idea of God.
Yeah. Well, Paul Tillich says that your idea of God is simply your ultimate concern.
I'm sorry.
Your idea of God is simply your ultimate concern. So, I mean, it seems to me you have some notion of an idea of God as something other than that. But, Martin, did you want to dip into this?
Well, I just want to say it sounds very dangerous to me to treat what the culture aspires to with God.
Well, it's the great human problem.
How does that leave any room to your basic critique of your surrounding culture?
Well,
you'd have to say,
Nietzsche hated Jesus.
Right, or something of that sort.
Or at the very least unnecessary.
Well, the other way that cultures find a center is that they have a mythological enemy that they defeated, and that defines who they are.
Could I take the conversation in a different direction, David, or do you think it's...
Just one moment. Gloria, was it this you wanted to speak to?
No, I wanted to ask if what you've said tonight relates to the conflict in our church as to whether to marry gays and lesbians, and the church is tearing it apart.
Sure it does.
Did you all hear?
No.
She wants to ask whether what Bishop Raymond said tonight relates to the conflict that's tearing the church apart, by which she means the Lutheran church. It's the whole church and the only church for Gloria, as you may The issue of same-sex blessing and the ordination of gay clergy.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
During
my 9 years as a bishop in the church, I heard the rhetoric over and over again. And the rhetoric always was that this is the thin edge of the wedge. We let these folks in, then who knows who's going to be next. And so the whole rhetoric was about some group of people out there that are just going to take the church and ruin it.
They already got women.
So of course it is. Yeah. I was just trying to avoid that one as one of the examples that I was using in my speech, that's all.
One half a second, you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Martin. Okay, entirely different direction. Because I thought that what you had to say about fear was very important. I had a lot of validity. When you talked about Copenhagen, it seemed to me you missed an immense opportunity to illustrate your own thesis. Because it wasn't so much that people feared what the scientists might be some sort of shenanigans.
It's a complex issue for many reasons. Even if it turns out not to be true that the industrial emissions of the Western industrial nations are what have caused climate change, the fact is the climate still is changing anyway. And the geopolitical challenges that the globe will have to face when maybe a quarter of a billion people turn into refugees is enormous. But nobody wants to start budgeting for that now.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.